Ave and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode XLIII, Virgil. If you know anything about Roman poetry, it's probably about the work of the poet Virgil, best known for his work on the blockbuster epic The Aeneid. Even if you don't know its storyline, you definitely know something that it's inspired. This episode was a listener request from Carlos Veloso in Brazil. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Publius Virgilius Maro, better known as Virgil, is, for very good reason, the best known poet from ancient Rome, often considered the finest exponent of the Latin language, the most important Roman poet. He's writing at the time of Augustus, and he's quite closely associated with the Augustan regime in some ways. Now, Virgil was born in 70 BCE, and he was born in a part of Italy which technically isn't really considered Italy at the time he's born. He's born in the very north, the time we call Cisalpine Gaul, educated in the way that a reasonably wealthy Roman family would educate their son, but he's not from a politically active family. He's kind of on the outer a little bit, coming from that bit of northern Italy. So we don't know too much about his early life, but we do know that he was absolutely grounded in Greek and Roman literature to the extent that a lot of people, for instance, my colleague Chris Mackey, think that he knew every word of Homer back to front, that he could have just recited the Iliad and the Odyssey to you.
Mm.
It's actually not that unlikely considering that memory is treated in a very different way in antiquity. So, you know, memorizing lines of poetry is something that is normalized for them, and it's something that actually is part of their education. It's a lot more expensive to get written texts.
Mm.
So being able to memorize them is really important, and it gives you a different relationship to literature, I guess, than the one we have.
What do we have as the earliest examples of his writing then?
Well, we have three major sets of poetry by Virgil. The earliest is called the Eclogues. You'll sometimes see it called the Bucolics, which is pastoral poetry written about shepherds or in the voice of shepherds. And we know that he published this in around 39 BCE.
Mm.
So he is in his 30s at that point.
I've read a bit of this. It seemed to be about a fencing dispute, if I remember the first... I'm being serious.
You mean in terms of boundaries, not in terms of epes?
Yeah.
Look, the Eclogues, which established Virgil as the most significant poet around at the time, as a really important poet, is a difficult set of poems. It's not a set of poems I teach to my first years, because it is written in the voice of shepherds, and it's often about land disputes. It's often quite sad poetry about people being thrown off their land, or people who have a background in the countryside having to go off to the city. So there's a lot about loss and love in this poetry, and some of it is love between men. It's written very much in a genre that we don't bother with very much anymore, which is the pastoral tradition. And it's Virgil laying claim to saying, I can do this genre, which had been particularly well written by a Greek poet called Theocritus, that I can do this in Latin, all right? Which is kind of what all Roman poets are doing in some way. Certainly by this point, Greek literature is so significant at Rome that to establish yourself, you have to say, I can write this genre and I can do it in Latin. Right. There are genres of Latin poetry as well, but because of the cultural significance of Greek literature, you have to be able to do it. And of course, it's not natural to Latin. You know, it was developed in Greek. So to be able to do it in another language is quite a skill.
Is he also writing what he knows?
Presumably to a certain extent, because he comes from somewhere that's not the center of power. He doesn't come from the city of Rome.
Mm.
He would have gone there, and he was educated in the centers of education in Greece, and he's gone to Rome. But it's not his background. On the other hand, please don't think that this is autobiography. He has never been a farmer. If he had been, then he wouldn't have the leisure to write poetry. So he's writing this poetry that's, there's obviously a lot of metaphor in it, in that he writes about political issues, through this poetry, which on the face of it is about these people who have very simple lives. But in fact, they have to deal with very complex issues. Like at the time, if we go back through the mists of our podcasts, we did discuss the civil wars that occurred and occurred pretty much throughout the first century BCE. Now, one of the effects of the civil wars is that people were thrown off their land for lots of different reasons. You know, the civil wars were occurring in Italy at certain points. So, you know, warfare on your land is never going to lead to stability. But also, after the wars, the generals want somewhere to put their veterans, or, you know, the people who backed them get rewarded.
Mm.
And one of the ways you do that is by throwing other people off their land and giving it to your partisans. It is thought that Virgil's family had suffered from this. They were actually exiled at some point, or, you know, dispossessed. So he's writing about what he knows, not because he was a farmer, but because he has seen the immediate effects of these political issues. But he's not addressing it straight on, all right? It's not like a news report. It's written about very much in this highly stylized way through a genre of poetry that comes from Greece. So it's very, very complicated. Mm. That's why I don't teach it to first years.
Okay, so how is his poetry received? I take it it's well received. It helps build up his reputation. Where does Virgil go?
Well, he becomes at some point part of the literary circle of a man called Maecenas, who is very, very significant during this period because he's close to Octavian, who will become Augustus. And he never has a formal position in Augustus's administration, but he's clearly, you know, he's close to the center of power and often seen as one of Augustus's right-hand men when he does come to power. So, as is always really true at Rome, poetry and politics are never completely divorced, but through this connection, through the patronage of a man who is close to somebody who will be the eventual victor in the civil wars, Virgil, he's just one step away from the center of power.
Mm. So he's got support, he's got a bit of a reputation. What does Virgil write next, or what do we know from his works next?
Well, he writes a set of poems every 10 years is how it works out. Around 29 BCE, he publishes the Georgics. The Eclogues was 10 short poems. Georgics is 4 slightly longer poems, or written in 4 books. Think again about the context of this. 29 BCE is the time when Octavian has won the civil war against Antony and Cleopatra, but he's yet to get back to Rome and claim his triumph, and he's yet to be given the name Augustus. So it's right at that point of transition where he's clearly the victor, but we don't know what's going to happen next. So you could think of it as a period of doubt in a way. What does Virgil do during this period? Of course, he's not writing it bang in 29. He spent the whole of the 30s working on this. He writes these 4 books, which are technically on farming, what we call didactic poetry, which is poetry that teaches you how to do something. Now, this, again, is in another Greek tradition. It's a Greek genre, which had been around from very early in Greek poetry. So the most famous exponent of this is a poet called Hesiod, who is writing around the same time as Homer, so probably around 700 BCE. So it's really formative stuff. If you tried to practice farming based on what Virgil tells you in the Georgics, I don't think you'd get very far, because as many interpreters have seen, it's all very metaphorical. It's about the place of work, you know, that you have to put the work in to get the results. It's about what happens when you're at the mercy of the elements. Very easily read as at the mercy of the political changes that are going on, right? The changes in regime. Again, very intricate poetry. Remember, he's taken 10 years to write this poem, right? Some people have calculated that Virgil wrote over his career between 1 and 3 lines a day. There's an awful lot that you can read into it, which of course people have. And one of the things they've discussed with regard to this poem is it pro or anti-Octavian, which kind of dogs Virgil throughout, because he's writing exactly at that time. So has he taken a stance on Octavian, to whom he's technically close through being part of the circle of Maecenas, but is he being critical of him? And critics have taken very different views on this. So until recently, one of the popular views on Virgil is that there's a lot of anti-Augustanism, anti-Octavian in there. The present state of play on Virgil is that, like other poets writing at the time, he's not necessarily pro or anti, but he can't help dealing with the issues that come up through this. So he can't help but deal with the issues of dispossession. One of my favorite passages in the Georgics is he sort of sees this future farmer who's going to be digging away at his land, plowing the land, and he will find the armor of a civil warrior.
Right.
So the land itself has been, you know, sort of soaked in this civil war blood.
Mm.
And the remains, or at least the armor that's been left behind, is still there, as if the land of Italy itself has been imbued with this terrible, terrible period. He's also got a very famous passage where he praises Italy, this great panegyric on how beautiful this land is, and it's the perfect middle between too cold and too hot, and, you know, it's the ideal place to live, which some people have seen as jingoistic, but it's actually just a very lovely hymn to his homeland in many ways. And of course, you can read that politically too, because Italy is at the center of all of these power disputes at this point. So it's extremely well-executed poetry, which the English poet John Dryden said was the greatest poem written by the greatest poet. But it also has all of these different ways you can read it politically. All right, so the Georgics is very interesting from that point of view, particularly from the way that it treats Italy itself. I think it's kind of interesting, actually, that he moves from poetry, which on the face of it is about shepherds, you're herding sheep and goats, to a kind of poetry that, again, on the face of it, is about the process of ploughing the land and, you know, keeping bees and also keeping cattle and so on. And you know, there's a lot of intricate stuff in there about how you graft a vine and that kind of thing, which my students find fascinating. And then he's going to move on to one that's about building cities. Well, so he kind of moves through civilization in his poetry.
Yeah, but not even that. He goes from agriculture, all this agriculture kind of work, to suddenly an epic. And his audience must be going, where the hell have you been keeping that? You know, suddenly the blockbuster comes out. Wow, Virgil, why have you been telling us about beekeeping and fence disputes when you could have been telling us about Aeneas?
Well, partly that's a very modern view, of course. I mean, Virgil was very popular from the Eclogues and the Georgics, but his next work is the epic poem that we remember him for, the Aeneid, which is mythological, which deals with the Trojan War at the very beginning. So it's something that I think we find a lot easier to engage with, and it has a narrative that goes all the way through.
So can you give us a brief rundown on the story?
Absolutely, if people don't mind spoilers. It's been around for 2,000 years, so yeah. I think we can get away with it. Okay, it's a story that's very much born out of Greek mythology and the myth of the Trojan War. And in the Homeric epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey, the Iliad in particular deals with the Trojan War. There is this almost a throwaway line that one of the Trojans, a man called Aeneas, who's a member of the Trojan royal family, will be the one who will survive and will kind of carry on the line.
So that throwaway line's in Homer's work.
It is, okay. Yes. And the Romans had a myth that their people was actually descended from this remnant of Troy, this survivor of Troy. Because, of course, as everyone knows, I think, the Greeks won the Trojan War. And one of the things they did was to wipe out most of the Trojans, especially the men. However, Aeneas escapes. So where does he go when he escapes? Well, the Romans said he came to Italy. He's the founder, or at least his son is the founder of the Roman race. It gets mentioned all over the place elsewhere. Of course, Virgil is not the first to deal with it. And according to this myth, at least in Virgil's version, Aeneas leaves Troy after his city is destroyed. And he has this kind of ragtag collection of followers. And at the very beginning of the epic, they are shipwrecked, not in Italy at all, but on the shores of North Africa in what will be Carthage. Carthage is being built. And it's being built by a woman called Dido. She herself is an exile from what is now Lebanon, and she and Aeneas fall in love. In books 2 and 3 of the epic Aeneas, there's a flashback. This is not something we invented. It's actually there in Homer, let alone in Virgil. There's a flashback where Aeneas tells Dido how he got there. So he tells her a very famous retelling of the fall of Troy. So if you want to have a narrative, there's no narrative, or no lengthy narrative in Homer of the fall of Troy. It's there in Virgil, an outstanding book of poetry where he tells of the horrors of that night and how the Trojans are tricked by the Trojan horse. And then he tells of his wanderings with his, you know, the remnants of the Trojan people. And then in book four, Dido falls apart because Aeneas leaves her. And this is a very significant book. He is told to leave her and go to Italy. He's not meant to be in Carthage. In fact, Carthage will be the big enemy of Rome. So what is he doing helping to build Carthage when he should be off in Italy? So he leaves her. Dido kills herself at the end of that book. She's a very sympathetic character. So that's a bit of a problem for the character of Aeneas in some ways. Then eventually he comes to Italy. He has a little trip to the underworld on the way there, which is quite exciting. And in the second half of the epic, it's 12 books long, in books 7 to 12, there is war in Italy because he's not greeted with open arms. He is sort of accepted by some of the Italians, the Latin people, and he's seen as somebody who was fated to come and to marry the daughter of the native Italian king. The king's called Latinus, she's called Lavinia. However, she is sort of, or at least in the mind of this man, engaged to a man called Turnus, who's a local prince, and he and Aeneas have a civil war. Remember, civil war has just happened in Italy, so this is a war within Italy. I guess as an outsider, as a Trojan, it's not technically a civil war. There's war in Italy, terrible, bloody, brilliantly described, ends with Aeneas and Turnus having a duel, because how else do you end a big epic? You don't end it with just a battle where everybody flattens the others. You end it with your two heroes coming together. What we get actually is a kind of rerun of the Trojan War. And Virgil's very specific about this. He actually tells us through a prophetic character, a priestess. She says, you know, the Trojan War is going to happen again. And I see, she actually has a famous line in it. She says, I see the river Tiber running with blood. In the Trojan War, as described by Homer, and Homer's text is very, very important, both the Iliad and the Odyssey, but perhaps particularly the Iliad at this point. What we get towards the end of the Iliad is this big duel between the Greek hero Achilles and the Trojan prince Hector. They finally come together. There's only one inevitable conclusion, in that Achilles is the great, strong warrior, and of course he kills Hector. And then at the end of the Iliad, there's actually a couple of books of reconciliation or near reconciliation between Achilles and Hector's father. So you have to bear that in mind when you come to the end of the Aeneid, because we have a similar situation where Achilles wants to kill Hector because Hector has killed his close friend Patroclus. In the Aeneid, Aeneas has an ally, actually a Greek ally, who has given his son, who's called Pallas, to fight with them. And Aeneas is sort of in a position of having to look after this young man. He's sort of the in loco parentis in place of the father. And Turnus kills him. Turnus kills Pallas on the battlefield. So Aeneas is filled with this terrible rage and wants to go and get revenge. And right at the end of the Aeneid, right at the end of book 12, he fights Turnus, he wounds him. Turnus begs for mercy, and Aeneas considers sparing him. He looks down, he sees the belt that Turnus has stripped from the body of Pallas, which he's now proudly wearing, and he's filled with rage, and he kills him. And that's the end of it. So Virgil kind of redoes Homer. You shouldn't really think of it like that. It's, you know, it's fantastic poetry, very dramatic, but he refers to Homer constantly. But he kind of doesn't, because one of the important things to remember is that in the Iliad, you get these two books, which to a certain extent give you mourning and reconciliation. And the end of the Aeneid is just death and revenge. So that's quite telling. And of course, that has spawned many, many readings. I mean, many, many readings of this poem anyway. But the ending in particular is very controversial because it doesn't follow the line of Homer. Now, we should perhaps bear in mind that Virgil died in 19 BCE, which is when the Aeneid was released, although books had been released to a certain extent. You know, people had heard bits of it before that point. We're told by his perhaps slightly dubious biography that he wanted it burned because it was unfinished, that the Aeneid should be burned. He did not want it released because he hadn't finished it. In fact, there are half lines in the Aeneid. There are lines that aren't completed.
Mm.
Would he have gone through and finished those? And some people think, would he have gone to the end of the Aeneid and given it an easier ending in some ways, not just ending with this very blunt death? I don't think he would have done, personally.
It's Augustus who wanted it released, though, didn't he?
Very much so. Yeah. And, you know,
when the emperor's a big fan, okay, you release the book.
I'm not sure there was ever any question that it wouldn't, given Virgil's reputation, would you really bury something like this? But certainly, you know, I guess it causes problems for people who read it as a very anti-Augustan text, and many people have, because certainly warfare and the misery it causes, there's no stint on that. You don't think of the Romans as only being celebratory about militarism, because that's certainly not there. Well, it's not the only story in the Aeneid. There's a lot of mourning, there's a lot of misery, there's a lot of attention paid to loss. Augustus certainly didn't want to bury this text, and there were people who were censored under Augustus. This wasn't a time of great free speech.
Yeah, so, look what happened to Ovid.
Yeah, exactly. It certainly seems that Augustus himself did not read this as something which was antithetical to his regime. We can say that at the very least. One of the ways we know that Virgil was reading his poem to people, and specifically to the Augustan family, is that there's a story in Suetonius, this is in the life of Augustus, that Virgil was reading an extract from the Aeneid to Augustus and his family, including Augustus's sister Octavia. And he read out to her a section from Book 6 of the Aeneid. Now, that's one of the sections where Virgil gets to talk about Aeneas's future. And he actually has this very elaborate section in the underworld where the souls of people yet to be born are kind of there in this parade. And so he can go through this list of great Romans who will be born, many of them military or political heroes. One of them is a man called Marcellus. And the poet knows that Marcellus, who was the son of Octavia, therefore the nephew of Augustus, would die very young.
Mm.
He was an adult, and he was one of the people who was in line to be the successor of Augustus, but one of those many people who died before Augustus did. So obviously this is a very poignant point, and he's reading this out to the mother of Marcellus to say, you know, what a great Roman this is, oh, but how terrible he will be cut off in his prime. And we're told that at that point, Octavia fainted. She was so overcome with this very poignant retelling.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, well, yeah, you do think that, don't you? But what it gives us is it's a great anecdote, and it's actually inspired artworks of its own, paintings.
This story of Aeneas isn't a creation of Virgil, but he tells it in his own way. But this is an established mythological origin story for Rome.
It is.
How much do we have historical evidence for what went on here? So aren't there parallels that he's worked into his work directly for what's going on?
In terms of the myth of Aeneas, it is a myth, of course. But there's no doubt that Virgil makes contemporary references all the way along. One of the ways he does it is by having prophecies. It's easy to prophesy the future when it's actually the past, because the story of Aeneas is set in 1200 BCE. So you can have people from this mythical past talk about, you know, the future that's going to happen. We're going to rerun the Trojan War, or Carthage will be the great enemy. Well, that's exactly what has happened in Roman history. There are also more subtle ways of referring to recent history. And one of the things that literary historians have noted a lot is that in Book 2, in that amazing retelling of the fall of Troy, the king of Troy, Priam, is killed in a very brutal way, actually by Achilles' son. And he's beheaded. The corpse of Priam, who had been this great king, who had ruled this very powerful state, is just left headless on the beach, which every contemporary Roman would immediately think of Pompey the Great. Pompeius Magnus had been involved in the civil war with Julius Caesar and had fled to Egypt. And in order to please Julius Caesar, Ptolemy had Pompey's head cut off. did not please Caesar, so it was failed in that way. But again, Pompey the Great, who had been this very powerful Roman politician and military figure, is left as this headless corpse. So there are contemporary resonances in there. And again, even though he's writing about a mythological past, Virgil is sort of writing about the present, and there's no doubt about that. And one of the things that people have noted about Virgil here is that there may well have been pressure on him to write an epic about Augustus or about the civil wars that had just happened. And that in many ways would have been quite difficult because there are people still alive who are involved in that. So what he does is he writes an epic that's sort of about the foundation of Rome and Roman values, but he situates it in the very remote mythological past. So he's dealing with qualities that are very important to Romans, that are significant to them culturally. For example, the big word that comes out a lot in the Aeneid is a word pietas, P-I-E-T-A-S, which doesn't really mean piety. It means attention to duty, doing the right thing by your family, by the gods, by the state, acting in a correct and moral way. Aeneas is often called Pius Aeneas, so he's the pious one or the dutiful one. But, you know, one of the ways of reading the Aeneid against the grain is that he doesn't always act in accordance with these values. So is leaving Dido actually Pius? In a way it is, because his duty is to found the Roman race. But in doing that, has he misled her? You know, it's not easy. Virgil doesn't just give us this easy, courageous, moral hero who is always right. And of course, perhaps most importantly, what he does at the end of the poem, people have argued about for decades, centuries. Yeah. Is it the right thing to kill Turnus?
Should he show mercy? Yeah.
Julius Caesar had shown mercy.
Both the Iliad and the Odyssey, but the Aeneid as well, strike me very much as kind of almost the template for what epics have become. So they seem like very influential work. I mean, I'm not just thinking about fantasy epics and mythology epics. I'm also thinking about, you know, like Star Wars and the ending with the fights between Luke and Darth Vader. And, well, Lord of the Rings seem to follow this epic kind of journey that you go on. And they seem to be really kind of influential. Is this where this sort of template comes from?
Absolutely. And of course, it's there in Homer, which is for us, because it's what we've got, the foundation of Western literature. What Virgil does, though, is that he marries the two themes from the Iliad and the Odyssey. So the Iliad is largely a poem of warfare. The Odyssey is about a journey and then, a homecoming. And in the Aeneid, you very deliberately get both of those things. You kind of get them in reverse order. So you've kind of got it all packaged there in the Aeneid, I think. And those themes do continue to come up again and again. And of course, Star Wars is still dealing with the issues of family. You know, who is your family? Who is your enemy? Sometimes the two are intermingled. It's very much there in the Aeneid, because Aeneas fights the Italians and then he's going to marry into them and become the founder of a really significant Italian people. And George Lucas himself has acknowledged that his mythic paradigms come largely from Rome. So they are really significant in terms of the way that we have epic narratives now. And the Aeneid itself was sort of the important text for all poetry that followed, in a way, so in the Western tradition, but all epics that came after it, they're all referring back to the Aeneid and pointing out similarities and differences. We've talked about the poet Ovid. He writes a very bizarre alternate kind of epic that's much more fragmented. But then you get other Roman poets, like the poet Lucan, who wrote that epic that Virgil didn't, the epic of the civil war between Julius Caesar and Pompey. And it's a very, very bloody, strange epic with no real hero. So he's kind of responding to Virgil, who clearly has a hero, but he's in some ways what we would call a conflicted hero these days.
Yeah.
So everybody's kind of doing a turn on Virgil. So he becomes the text, as it were. And behind that is always Homer. But I think because of the way that Western literature worked, which is that Latin was often better known than Greek throughout, say, the Renaissance, Virgil's poetry become influential texts for writers of that period and beyond. And so even if you haven't read Virgil, you probably have read or seen dramas that are heavily influenced by what he wrote.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University, and you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it on iTunes. Please leave a review there and tell your friends about it. Our way to our over 2,000 Facebook fans. If you're not one of them, you should go on there and give us a like. You can also follow both myself and Rhiannon Evans on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. That's it today for this episode of Emperors of Rome. Next time, we'll have another listener request. So until then, I'm Matt Smith, Carthago delenda est, and thanks for listening.